You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, March 5th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Aloha.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Cinco de Marcho.
Cinco de Marcho. Jay, welcome back from Hawaii.
Yeah, Jay.
Thanks, guys.
Hey, Jay. It's good to have you back.
It's my annual vacation to a warm place.
Nice. How was the Maui Wowie?
I didn't go to Maui. I was in Kauai.
He doesn't have a clever rhyme for that.
Are you still on your Kauai high?
You know how it is. I mean, it's so dreamlike when you're on vacation, especially to a beautiful place like Hawaii. Then you get on the 12-hour plane ride coming home, and you go through the whole airport hell, and they lost my luggage, and then come home, and the weather sucks, and you go back to work the first day, and you're literally, you know, looking for the gun. You're just like, no!
Well, that's a real cheery wrap up there. Yeah, thanks, yeah. Jay.
But I could talk about the good stuff.
Tell us about your investigations.
All right, well, just so you know, Kauai is probably the most lush of the islands. And other than just having a fantastic time and everything, I did meet a lot of locals. There's a lot of locals to meet on that island. And I asked a lot of questions. The only thing I could dig up on Kauai, you will actually find anywhere people like to go vacation. What I did do is I went on a tour of a timeshare. And this wasn't my first time doing it. I usually do it when I go on a vacation if I think that what they're going to give me is worth it. Like, you know, a lot of times they'll give you vouchers for, you know, the trips that you can go on, or you can get, you know, just flat out cash, or sometimes you'll get an extension on the hotel you're staying at. I mean, there's a million different things that they do. But what I decided to do was go on the tour more for the SGU than for what I got, because I only got about maybe $50 worth of value out of it, and it took an hour and a half. So, you know, I did it. I already knew about timeshares. I knew about the scam. There was no chance of me falling for it. And to quickly go over it, there's three kinds of timeshares. There are legitimate ones that are actually good. Good meaning that you're not going to get ripped off. The properties are good quality. They're maintained well. And you probably can trade, you know, your place or the week that you bought. Like, let's say you do a timeshare where you're purchasing 1 week out of the year that you want to stay in some place in Mexico, right? Some hotel that you like in Mexico. It's possible that just purchasing that week at that place can get you into other hotels all over the world. And that's the basic concept is you're buying like 1 or 2 weeks of 52 weeks, right? So you're paying a portion, or a very small portion, of the overall cost of the entire property. Or you buy points, and those points buy you the week. You could buy enough points to buy 2 weeks, or say it's a really, really awesome resort, then, you know, those 2 weeks of points of, you know, Hotel A will only buy you 1 week in Hotel B. So anyway, so there's a quality ones that you can trust that are good. There's also the incredibly overpriced ones that are a total ripoff, and typically these are the ones that, you know, the properties are probably still good, but they're just flat out overpriced and it's not worth it. It's not worth putting the money in. And then there's the fraud ones. And in my opinion, most timeshares are borderline overpriced slash a fraud, because once it's too overpriced, basically it is a fraud. It's not a bad idea to do the timeshare if the vacation will roughly cost you what it would cost to just vacation there anyway, right? That makes sense. If it's a little bit more expensive, but you know, you get some perks being in the timeshare, that's cool. And maybe you can still trade that week for some other places around the world. That would work out too. But here is a bunch of reasons that you shouldn't purchase the timeshare. And this is where the scam comes in. One of the things that they tell you is this is a really good financial investment. Pretty much across the board, no timeshare is worth the money you put into it as far as an investment goes. It's worth paying as a vacation, but it's not worth the actual – it's not an investment that you will make money on. No way, no chance. I don't buy it. I've never seen it. I've never heard anyone say it. And if anything, everyone I've known in my life that's bought a timeshare tried to sell it and couldn't, or if they did, they lost their shirt. You also – another thing that they do is they'll say you'll make a lot of money renting it out. Well, you probably won't, because if I can rent a room in that same hotel that you bought a timeshare in for equal cost, you're not going to make any more money. It's pretty straight out obvious. Or if they tell you, that you easily can resell or even make a profit from buying it. Like they say, the whole, you buy it at this price, that price is locked in, and then in 10 years you sell it, and you're going to make a profit. That's not going to happen. Or they'll tell you that the company will buy the timeshare back from you, and sometimes for a profit. No way, that never happens. And you know, I just never heard any stories or read anything that said, yeah, the company actually bought it back and it was no problem. Usually, when they start getting into that technique, that's a lie. That's an out-and-out lie when they start getting into those things that I just listed. Other things that they do very, very well, and I don't care what timeshare you go to, typically the salesmen are some of the slickest salesmen that you'll come in contact with. One thing that they do, which is very strange, is that most of these timeshare salesmen can write and read perfectly upside down. And they're trained to do that so they never turn away any of the brochures or any of the stuff that they're using, the materials, to sell you the property. And it's just a weird thing that I've noticed, and I actually looked it up and found out that that's one of the traits that these timeshare salesmen have. Another thing that they do...
So they always have the brochure in your face upright to you, and they do all their reading and writing upside down to them.
It's like a workbook. It's like a workbook. So they have like a workbook where they're like, look at the pricing, and then they show you, and they do all these calculations, and then they're writing math upside down. They're reading off the brochure upside down. And it's just like, wow, how slicked out are these guys? Like, you just think, how long do you have to train to do this? How long would you have to, you know, be involved in this? Or what kind of training program do they put these people through in order to be able to behave like this?
It's obviously worth the investment for them, so it must be... The whole shebang is profitable. And just to emphasize, too, one of the scams is that they lure you in with some freebies.
Yeah, the prizes.
But then once they get you there, you're like a prisoner to the high-pressure sale, right? And then they do not want to let you go until they make a sale. And again, obviously, it's profitable to them, so they must be selling enough to offset whatever freebies they're giving out.
Yeah. Sounds a little cultish to me.
I've heard people actually say that I was prisoner there for hours. They wouldn't let us go.
I've never been prisoner for the hours routine. They definitely do like the bait and hook type of thing. They get you in with whatever it is that they promise. Now, there's
bait and switch.
There's timeshares that flat out say you're going to get a flat panel TV, and you don't get the flat panel TV. You get some other piece of junk or a small crappy TV. Or they do the thing where they make you think that you're getting the main prize, but you get the second or third prize. It's like the Cupid doll thing. You need to win these 10 Cupid dolls, and then you'll get the big one or whatever.
Okay, it's like a carnival game.
The typical sales routine is that you're greeted by someone. They either will start with a tour of the property, or they'll give you like a some type of sales pitch about the timeshare industry. You know, just to let you know, this is what timeshares are. And then there's some type of seminar where they either sit you down in a room full of people and they feed you and give you some drinks and stuff, and they just have like a really slicked out guy or girl come up and just do some wicked sales pitch and get you all kind of hyped up and excited. And then they bring you down to the salesman, the person that's going to really try to make the sale, and this is the person that you become very friendly with. So in my experience, I was always able to get past this person, and then they bring in the high-strung, really hard-sell manager. So they bring out the better salesman, and this guy always does the wicked high pressure. Like, how could you not do this? Like, you already just said, they collect all this information from you. How much do you spend a year on vacationing? What would it cost if you, went to all these different resorts? You couldn't afford these other resorts, and they kind of trick you with math and quick numbers and quick talk into thinking, wow, how could I not do this,
The psychological trick there, too, is they try to make you seem inconsistent. So these sales techniques are actually based upon legitimate psychological principles. People have a fear of seeming inconsistent to other people. So they'll tell you, how much do you spend on vacation a year? So you're telling me you will not spend less, you will not save money. Why would you do that? So then you have to sound like an idiot. And just to avoid sounding like an idiot, you'll go along with the sale.
This is how I got out of the one I just went on. First of all, the property was okay. It wasn't that good. So when we got in there and we knew, okay, we're going to give up this hour and a half, and we were trying to actually have some fun with the person. We were hoping to get a really high-pressured salesman. But this person that took us on the tour and everything, she was actually really nice. And she just started asking us the typical questions. How much do you spend? Where do you like to travel? And she gives us the book, and you see these 1,000 hotels that you can pick from. And then I just flat out told her at one point, I said, you know what? I don't like this property. I really don't like it here. It's actually nowhere near, it's not as good as the place we're staying. Well, where are you staying? Well, I told her, we're renting a house. And I said, so what, before I told her what I paid, and she asked, I said, before I tell you, you tell me how much it's going to cost me to buy this timeshare here. So she said, well, nice. And she does all the, does the numbers, writing upside down with a highlighter and doing all this stuff. And then she's like, well, it'll be $250 a night. And I said, we're renting a $10 million house for $6,000 a week, split up by three, and sometimes we travel with four couples, and we're paying about $230 a night or $236 a night per couple. I said, you know, it's a $10 million house on Hawaii, and it's only costing each couple this amount of money. We have a private bedroom, a private bathroom, a really nice room, a full awesome kitchen in a house that has its own yard right on the beach. Like I said, it's actually
cheap. Were you lying?
No, it's the truth. It's
That's
the truth.
True?
Well, do the math.
Basher, why don't you invite me?
Yeah, seriously, Jay. Why aren't we doing this podcast from that place?
You know, if you do the math, and this is actually a good thing that I am telling everyone, do it. Rent a house in these beautiful places, you know, and make sure that you're picking good neighborhoods and everything. But most of the times, especially if you're going to Hawaii, like it'd be hard. You look online, you see the house, like you could see that it's on the beach. You could see pictures of it on the inside. I mean, that's how we pick these houses. And it totally is worth it because you're alone. You have a whole house to yourself. So I told her that very quick story about how, the beautiful house that we're renting. And she goes, well, can you just sit here with me for another like 40 minutes so I don't get in trouble with my boss?
Oh, jeez.
Like we totally derailed her to the point where she didn't even like bring in the manager or anything because she knew that, look, these people know how to vacation. They know what they're doing. They know how to get value out of it. You know, we had it together. But listen to this. There was an old couple sitting next to us, and we heard the guy actually say, we will finance the timeshare for you, and we will charge you 17.5% on it. And I was like, wow, did you hear that? They're gonna actually, or the guy, I'm not exaggerating, the guy actually said that we'll do one of those interest-only loans. And if you don't know what that is, it's a loan that you only pay the interest on the loan. You never pay the principal down. So it's 100% profit for the company. Now, you have an old couple that could easily be quick-talked, easily think, oh, and I can give it to my kids and stuff, which, you know, a lot of times they say things like that during the sales pitch, but it's not in the contracts. And these people don't know until it's too late or they die or whatever happens and it doesn't get passed.
Well, part of what they do, one of the other sales techniques that they use is called getting you down to your final objection. And it's another psychological ploy that they do is they try to get you to say, all right, what's the one thing that's keeping you from making this sale? And most people will say, all right, just to get out of it, I'll say, I would do this except for this one thing, except for, you know, I want to be able to pass it down to my kids. Then they take away that final objection. Whatever it is, doesn't matter what it is, they will just say, okay, we'll fix that. We'll take away that one last objection. Now you have no objections left. Now you have to admit that you were lying in order to say you still don't want it. And most people, or a lot of people, will not do that. That psychological pressure works often enough. So that's probably what they were doing with that couple, is my point.
Oh, sure. And Steve, to be honest with you, I think people really are talked into these things against their will, most of the people, you know. And another quickie thing that they do, and I could just keep talking about this, but one thing that they do
is
they fake the sale. They actually like have a fake couple come in, and you know, and they always open like a little bottle of champagne when someone wins, and they have plants in there. They have people that they've put in there. Oh yeah, and the Jones just bought a timeshare. Then all the people stand up and start clapping. You know, all the employees stand up and start clapping. Congratulations! And they make this big whoop-de-doo about it. You know, and you're right, Steve. It's constant pressure, constant psychological manipulation.
Right.
Always be closing.
What's that?
Come on, I said always be closing. Come on.
Yeah, that's right.
Glengarry Glen Ross?
Yep.
You guys
now listen,
suck.
Guys.
Al Pacino.
So, guys, on a side note, and very funny, talking about trying to resell your timeshare, there were all these places where you could buy shave ice. They call it shave ice.
Italian ice?
You know, these people own shave ice machines. It's not really Italian ice. It's shaved ice. They put a block of ice in this machine, and they shave it up, and they just put different flavors in. It's really good. You know, it's like I guess it's like a common tourist treat. But check this out. All of these shave ice places on Kauai, it's like shave ice and timeshare resales. Like, these little booths actually resell the timeshares. And you go up to the booth and you order your shave ice and you flip through this little book and it has, like, you know, 100 or 200 of the timeshares for resale. That's how pathetic it is.
Oh, wow. God. It is pathetic.
And, I took a picture. Nice. I took a picture of one of my favorite ones that I went to a couple of times. But that is that's a good example of how ridiculous these timeshares are.
Wow! Shaved ice resell your timeshare.
Yep,
in one booth. I don't get
that's
it.
Like buying. It's like buying insurance from the hot dog salesman.
Well, I think what they're doing is they're trying to sell you other people's timeshares that they're pathetically trying to dump.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Oh man. I bet you get some good deals.
Well, especially if you order like the special flavor of the day, right?
Yeah.
Like pineapple or coconut.
Yeah. How much for the shave ice? $350. Well, how much for this house right here? This condo.
Comes with a free shaved ice?
$350. It comes with this. Bring it back to reality. Like I said, but there are reputable companies out there. You could get good deals at good properties and everything, but buyer beware, be very careful with these timeshares. And I'd say overall, unless you're very good with math and you know what's going on and you know what you're being presented, don't even bother going on it. But if you can do it, you know what? You actually can get some good stuff and some free stuff, money and tours and, you know, go on whatever, like a boat tour and stuff like that. They'll give you these things. You get stuff for free and you can even ask for more stuff. If you can handle it, go ahead and do it. And do it every vacation you go on, because if you're smart, you can get out quick and get a value out of it.
And do your homework.
What we need to do is start a multi-level marketing timeshare scam.
with some type of religion involved, Steve.
Well, let's move on. Thanks for that report, Jay.
Yeah, Jay.
My pleasure.
And welcome back. I almost forgot. There is one brief in memoriam this week. The world did lose a tremendous intellectual, a person that was very important in all of our lives. Gary Gygax passed away this past week.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that.
You heard about that?
You heard about it from me, you nerds.
Yeah. And if you don't know who Gary Gygax is, you know, it's not worth explaining. But for those of you who do, we mourn with you. All right, let's go on to the next news item.
Enough said.
Enough said.
Let's just say he rolled an 11 when he needed a 13 to survive.
Careful, Rebecca. You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, don't even try.
Don't go there, Rebecca.
Rolled an 11.
Because if the bulk of the male SGU panel here has any sacred cow, it's Gary Gygax. Okay?
Oh. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to help our listeners understand what's happened here.
Google him, Gary Gygax.
Evan, about Jesus. Jesus saves.
It only takes half damage.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
That's actually pretty. Yeah, Jesus saves is on the front side of the t-shirt, and on the back side of the t-shirt is, and only takes half damage. Again, total inside joke, but hilarious if you get it.
And no woman ever sees what's underneath the t-shirt.
God, you know what? I missed you guys so much. I feel like I've been out of it for a long, long time.
You have been. I mean, yes, we missed you too.
Bob, can you please explain to us why NASA is baffled?
Scientists are baffled.
Yeah. I love anomalies in physics. You would think that the relatively straightforward aspects of space probe missions involving something like velocity would be pretty well all ironed out by now. For years now, though, we've known of probes with velocities that we cannot explain. This may eventually lead to an obscure and mundane explanation, but it could also lead to new physics. It started in 1980. Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist John Anderson noticed something strange about the Pioneer 11 space probe launched in the early 70s. It was not where it was supposed to be. For each year of travel in the outskirts of our solar system, it covered a vast distance that was off by an amount equal to the width of the United States, about 3,000 miles, which is, in percentage-wise, that's not much, but considering how accurate we are with these things, it was huge and completely unexplained. A similar anomaly was occurring at the other end of the solar system with the Pioneer 11 probe. Now, nothing that Anderson and his colleagues looked at, whether it was the spacecraft behavior itself or what the solar system was like at the outskirts there, could explain this small but undeniable deceleration of these craft. Finally, in 1998, he went public with the announcement, and to this day, there's no definitive explanation for this anomaly. This doesn't mean that he didn't try, though. For years, he looked at every conceivable variable that he could look at. He looked at errors in computation. Of course, there could be a simple error in computation. But seven independent analyses have shown the same effect. What about drag? Maybe there's some sort of unusual drag from the interplanetary medium, including dust or solar wind or cosmic rays. But the densities that do exist out there are too small to cause the effect. What about gravitational forces? He looked at the gravitational forces from, say, the Kuiper Belt or even dark matter, but they didn't pan out either. Then this past week, there's been more press releases about other space probes that have been showing anomalies. This time, it's with the probes not at the edge of the solar system, but right by Earth as they fly by for gravitational assists, sometimes to save money so they don't have to launch that probes with so much fuel. They loop the probes around and around, and they come back to Earth to get a gravitational assist or to maybe to tweak their trajectory to save money, to save fuel. And of course, it adds
– like a slingshot, right?
Yeah, it could add years to their journeys, but hey, it saves money. So six of these probes have been studied, including the Galileos 1 and 2, the NEAR probe, Rosetta and Cassini and MESSENGER. Five of them showed that they were either slowed down or accelerated a little bit more than expected when they got close to Earth. Again, it was John Anderson and his colleagues that did much of these initial investigations. And for years now, they've been trying to figure out what's going on with these so-called flyby anomalies. They looked at measuring error. That didn't pan out because the Doppler shift that they use for the radio waves bouncing off the craft has a very minute error. It's only plus or minus 0.1 millimeters, but the effect they were seeing was in the range of, say, 4 millimeters per second difference. So this couldn't explain it. They looked at frame dragging. Now, that's what I initially thought when I read about these flyby anomalies. I thought, well, maybe frame dragging could explain this. This frame dragging occurs when you've got, for example, say, the rotating Earth actually dragging space-time along with it. I thought maybe that could actually explain the acceleration as it's approaching the Earth. But they actually looked into this, and they discounted it because the frame dragging would be far too weak to explain the discrepancies that they were seeing. So this is a really big mystery. Recently, Anderson and his buddies discovered an equation. They discovered by total serendipity an equation that duplicates these anomalies with the flybys. It explains these flybys in terms of the trajectory of the probes as they approach the Earth and then as they leave the Earth with respect to the plane of Earth's eclipse, of Earth's equator.
It sounds like what you're saying is they described it mathematically, but they haven't explained why it happens.
Yeah. Exactly. They could predict them very, very close to the actual measurements, but they still don't know why. They just explain it. So that might figure in. That might help them actually discover the real reason. But
wait,
it
I have
helps,
a question.
But it's not.
I'm wondering the mathematical formula they came up with. Did they come up with that before they noticed these discrepancies, and this happens to match it, or was it created specifically to address those discrepancies?
Yes, the latter. They as they were trying to figure out what was going on, they said, "Well, maybe it has to do with the way they approach the Earth," and they came up with these equations too.
Okay, so it's really not even described by mathematics at this point, since that's a post hoc sort of formula that's drawn up to explain it, but it hasn't been.
Yeah, I don't know the details of the equation, but it does explain all five of these flybys very well.
Well, yeah, I mean it's right. Like the cosmological constant. It's a fudge factor. You put it in there, and it accounts for the difference. In this is not a constant. It's actually an equation because it's more dynamic. But again, it doesn't tell us anything about the theoretical underpinnings of it. Although, of course, it makes sense that it would give us a clue. I'm assuming from what you're telling me, Bob, that the formula itself didn't produce a eureka moment where it's like, hey, this is this formula. So now we know exactly where it's coming from. They still don't know what the source of it is.
Right, and I've got just a couple more points to make. With this one. So the next question, an obvious question I think, should be, is there a connection between the Pioneer anomaly and the flyby anomalies? And the answer is it depends who you ask. Anderson says that he would be surprised if radio tracking of a spacecraft had revealed two completely independent anomalies. I suspect they are connected somehow, he says. But Peter And Triasson, who was a spacecraft navigation expert at JPL, doesn't think that there's a connection. He thinks that that they're different enough that they're probably different. And he said whatever causes this anomaly seems to make its impact just a few minutes before the closest approach to Earth regarding the flyby anomaly. And then lastly, does this point to new physics? And again, this depends on who you ask. Peter and Trace, that I mentioned above, believes that it will require a modified law of gravity or other new physics to explain it. But then you've got somebody like Miles Standish, who calculates trajectories of solar system bodies for JPL, and he says that he feels the Earth flyby anomaly is almost certainly due to an error in measurement or an incomplete analysis using ordinary physics. But he threw out a quote here that I don't agree with. He said an analogy. He said that it's like a farmer in Louisiana seeing a light in the sky and immediately screaming UFO. Now that's an interesting point, and that does regarding UFOs and lots of paranormal phenomena. That's exactly what happens, and that's a big problem with a lot of these phenomena is that people immediately jump to a paranormal conclusion without knocking down all the mundane things that science requires that you do. But I don't think this is a good analogy in this case because these people have been studying this for literally decades, for many, yeah, many years. They've knocked down lots and lots of these mundane possibilities, and they haven't made any progress in coming up with an answer. So I think after such an effort, I think you can start thinking, all right, you know, is there some new physics involved that nobody is, you know, claiming this 20 years ago. I have, you know, only recently have they started to say maybe there's some new physics, and I think it's valid to actually start, you know, looking around and trying to looking at it from that angle at this point.
With the current equations and the way that they understand how this slowdown happens, can they adjust for that?
It's consistent for the data that they have, say for the Pioneer anomaly. The thing is, though, a lot of the data, like the first 20 years of the data for the Pioneers, have been sitting around gathering dust in these old media formats. They're obsolete, so they actually had to raise a lot of money. Millions of dollars, in fact, to actually get this data and get it into one format for the entire history of the Pioneer probes, all, you know, whatever 30 years or so of the probes. And that process is ongoing, and I think it should be done fairly soon. And that might be the answer to the question. If you could study the Pioneer probes from their launch till we lost contact with them, it might be very helpful. It shed some new light on these.
Yeah,
let me make
a couple of points too, Bob. So just to follow up on what Jay was saying, but we haven't had a chance to test their fudge formula going forward. When you apply it retrospectively to existing data sets, it explains the difference between what we expect and what we're seeing. But we have yet to use this to predict where a probe is going to be. Right, in the future. That will be the ultimate test, and I don't know if that...
There's talks of actually launching a probe to address this issue specifically.
Now, the other point was, I think that the paranormal analogy would be apt if someone were saying that the solution to this anomaly is space ghosts. Right, there are obviously ghosts out in space pushing on these probes. That is the actual. That's the equivalent
ghosts.
Of what the ghost hunters are doing.
They see a ghost. Sorry.
Yeah, they see an anomaly, and they declare it is an alien or a ghost or a cryptozoological creature or whatever. But these guys are going through the process. They're as you said, they're laboriously ruling out things that we know of, and then they're just hypothesizing about what kind of thing could explain the, and then they'll test those hypotheses. So they're not doing what the ghost hunters do, which is leap from anomaly to ghosts.
Right.
And that was a point I was going to bring up, because this is what real scientists do with anomalies.
Absolutely, and that's why I disagreed with that comment that it's like a Louisiana farmer seeing a light and saying UFO. It's not. I don't think
it was
a good analogy.
Yeah.
It might have been a good analogy. Yeah, it's not fair. In 1980, if Anderson looked at this and said, "Oh, this must be new physics," without looking at a leaking gas tank, so many possibilities that he's discounted.
And it sounds like we're still left with three broad types of errors that we could be seeing. Either this is a mathematical type of a problem, but it sounds like that's the easiest one to eliminate, and that's been pretty well eliminated. although it's hard to say it's been eliminated 100%, or it's astronomical. It's something about the physical solar system, that the space that these probes are moving through that we don't fully understand yet, or it's physical.
Right.
It's something wrong with the physics, like gravity, and we need actually a more
right.
subtle description of gravity in order to accommodate this anomaly, which would be exactly how, you know, we discovered the need for general relativity was because of anomalies in the orbit of Mercury, for example.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think another option, Steve, is the probe itself. Some weird interaction
right.
between various components of the probe might be causing this effect, something that's not readily apparent to these scientists. So that's an option as well.
Right. Okay, let's go on to the next news item. This one having to do with aromatherapy. Now, aromatherapy has been around for a while. This is basically a brand or a category of snake oil in which substances which have a specific odor, usually a pleasant odor, is said to have therapeutic effects, hence aromatherapy. And like much of these types of these products, never really subjected to rigorous scientific testing.
Now, before we get into this, can we get all the puns out of the way? Like, you know, this smells fishy to me.
Right, right.
Anyone else? Smells like BS.
Yeah, but it's out of our system now. All right, go ahead.
Recently, researchers at The Ohio State University conducted one of the really only scientifically rigorous studies that I've seen on aromatherapy. And what they did was they looked to see if there was any physiological effects from smelling different allegedly aromatherapeutic scents. Lemon oil was one and lavender was the other one, which is, you know, with medical studies, if you're studying the response to an intervention, you could either look for the net clinical effect. You know, what did it make you, this disease process better or this symptom better, or you could look at and/or, because they're not mutually exclusive, you could look at physiological responses. Is it doing something physically to the body that we can measure? This study was focused on the physiological effects, not any, you know, a net clinical effect. And what they found was that there weren't any. Basically, there was no physiological effects. All the things that they chose to measure.
Surprise.
All the typical physiological parameters were not affected, and by either of these odors. And it also didn't matter if you were a believer in aromatherapy or not a believer in aromatherapy. The scents didn't alter physiology, even when some of the volunteers, the subjects in the study, felt that they were getting a clinical effect. They felt that their mood was elevated or whatever. There still wasn't any measurable physiological effect.
I think we need to lump this in with feng shui under things that might be nice in some regard, but don't actually have magical powers. Like, feng shui can make your house look nice, but probably won't bring you riches. And that aromatherapy candle smells delicious, but is not going to cure
right.
your cancer.
That's right.
I'm not sure that they're necessarily claiming that. Whatever is there. I mean, don't they keep it very generic about these kind of claims with things like aromatherapy? Makes you just feel better, and it makes you, you know, more relaxed. And
well, some of it's a lot like the feng shui, actually. Like, this candle will bring you good fortune.
Promote healing.
Or it'll get you in that mindset. Yeah, promoting healing. Yeah, BS stuff like that.
But a lot of it oriented, Evan, you were right. Aromatherapy specifically is very, a lot of the claimed effects are in the mood arena rather than more the biological arena. Probably because odors do carry, you know, emotions with them. Our olfactory system is just evolutionarily tied very closely to the memory part of our brain, the limbic system, and especially the memory of feelings and emotions. That's why I'm sure we've all had this experience. An odor can suddenly bring back not only a memory, but the
trigger
feelings that go along with that memory. You know, so that's probably why aromatherapy, you know, has the following that it does. But any claims to any real physiological effects are not backed by anything scientific. And so far, this study included, any attempt to rigorously look to see if there's any effect has come up negative. The next news item, now this is a pseudo-political item. You know, we are an educational organization, and the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is, you know, we're all about science education. That's what we talk about. But we do cover issues that intersect with politics and religion and sociology and other things like that. We never endorse candidates or get into purely political discussions. We try to be as politically neutral as we can be. But, and I'm saying this to preface this issue because this is about one of the candidates in the American election that's going on right now. And this has been, you know, but every science blogger that I read commented on this, including myself, of course. John McCain, when thrown a question recently about autism and vaccines, actually made some very, very unscientific comments. He said, and he's quoted by ABC News as saying, "It's indisputable that autism is on the rise amongst children. The question is what's causing it, and we go back and forth, and there's strong evidence that indicates that it's got to do with the preservative in vaccines."
Oh, boy.
Wrong and wrong. Actually, it's
shit.
Both of those, both the factual scientific claims that were made in that statement were actually incorrect. It is not indisputable that autism is on the rise. That requires clarification. The number of diagnoses is increasing, but the evidence and the consensus of opinion is that this is because of increased surveillance and increased spectrum of the diagnosis. So we've broadened the definition and we're looking for it more. So we're finding it more. But when you do studies that are designed to answer the question, is the true rate of autism rising? The answer appears to be no, that the true rate is actually pretty stable over time. So that's wrong. And of course, this is an issue that I've written about and we've talked about on this podcast many times. There is no credible evidence that there's any link between vaccines or the thimerosal, the preservative in some vaccines, and autism. And McCain doesn't seem to be aware of the fact that thimerosal was basically removed from all routine childhood vaccines by 2002. And we talked about the fact that removing it from vaccines did not cause a decrease in autism rates. It didn't even cause a decrease in the rate of increase. So that, you know, unfortunately, was just a scientifically incorrect, you know, couple of statements made by John McCain specifically. Now, I emailed I actually talked to somebody from the John McCain campaign on the phone and got the press email and sent in two actually formal requests for clarification on John McCain's position, and I have not received any response yet, and I have not found any press release or anything on the John McCain website. So there's been no clarifying statement made about that as of the time that we recorded this podcast. If I do get any response from the McCain campaign or one crops up somewhere, if they make a statement on their website or to somebody else, we'll do the follow-up and we'll let you know. And also, out of interest, and just to be a little thorough, just to be fair, really, I checked out the other still two viable candidates in the current American presidential election, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, just to see if they had anything to say about this issue. You know, you don't want to single anybody out. Now, Hillary Clinton, she is making healthcare a centerpiece of her campaign. So she had a lot to say, actually, about autism. But a lot of it is...
Oh.
And this is officially on her website. And this is like she has a position on it. And she's also spoken about it quite a bit. But she focuses a lot on healthcare delivery.
Really?
And we're going to give more, you know, delivery of care to people with autism. And she also talks a lot about funding more research. And all of her statements that on her website, she's actually got a lot to say about autism on her website, but all of her statements are reasonably scientific. She only said one thing, which I thought was inappropriate. And I thought this was probably pandering. And she wants to increase, expand research, but she specifically says that we need to find out the cause of autism. We need to do research into the causes of autism, including possible environmental causes. Now, it's subtle. It's subtle, but
so
that, you know, knowing
this
issue inside and out the way I do, that's not accidental that you would put that statement in there. First of all, I think it's inappropriate for a politician to be directing research at that level. Where we put our resources and our priorities, that's a political question. Are we going to prioritize research into autism versus something else? Absolutely, that's a political question. But scientists don't need politicians to tell them what questions to ask or where to look for the causes of autism. You know, scientists should decide if they should emphasize genetic versus environmental factors. But of course, there's a huge contingent of people in the autism world, especially a lot of grassroots, you know, organizations who think that there are environmental causes. So the only real purpose to put that in there would be to pander to those individuals, in my opinion. So that was the only statement that she made that I thought was inappropriate.
That's right. It protects herself later in case she's asked the direct question. She said, "Oh well, I commented."
Did not contradict the consensus of scientific opinion. That was the only thing that stuck out for me.
But now, Steve, say it is Hillary and McCain and they're going at it. Do you think she will pull that out of her bag of tricks and say, "Hey, McCain, look at this. You totally blew this. You totally missed the scientific consensus."
I don't know. It'll be very interesting to see if she does, because if she does that, then she's going to be isolating or alienating that whole segment that she may have been trying to, you know, softly pander to a little bit there. So we'll see. Of course, this is why we want to have the science debate 2008, right? We want to have the candidates,
yes,
whoever they end up being. Yep. Of course, it's already been decided that it's going to be McCain on the Republican side. It's still Barack Obama versus Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side. We want to put all these science questions to them, you know, give them an opportunity to clarify that. I mean, this is just another example of why, you know, our politicians need to be scientifically literate, need to have good science advisors, need to be up on the science so they don't make statements that contradict the Center for Disease Control and the American Academy of Pediatrics and basically the consensus of world scientific opinion. Now, Barack Obama's statements on autism actually were the most scientific of all the ones that I read, and it just from reading it seems like his advisors and or maybe even him personally know what the scientific consensus of opinion is, and they state it. So, for example, he writes, "As diagnostic criteria broaden and awareness increases, more cases of autism have been recognized across the country." That's exactly correct. And so he got that exactly correct.
Wow.
So he didn't say much else about, yes, about autism, except that, we're going to do more funding and more resources. That's great. But the scientific statements that he did make were right on the money in terms of the scientific consensus. It's interesting to see how the different candidates handle such a dense and controversial scientific issue, and I do think it does bring to the fore once again the need to have like a science debate among the highest levels of politicians running for office. The public does need to keep our politicians honest in terms of the science. You know, they can't come out, they can't start spouting off pseudoscientific nonsense or just completely contradict the consensus of scientific opinion as if they know something special.
I think it's really disheartening.
It is. Regardless of what your politics are, it's always disappointing to see a major politician make a scientific gaffe like that. They should know better.
The last thing we need is another scientifically illiterate president, you know?
And again, just to be crystal clear, none of this is meant to either, you know, politically endorse or be against any specific candidates, just to specifically discuss the scientific issues. Well, let's move on to some of your questions and emails. Quite a few of our listeners sent us an email alerting us to the fact that an online skeptical comic that goes by Kectic.com, Kectic.com, that is an acronym, we are told, although no disclosure as to what it stands for. And this is written by an SGU listener, actually, but it goes by the name of Rudis, R-U-D-I-S. And the latest one, actually it's no longer the latest one, but it was at the time, features yours truly in the comic.
And looking good.
And yeah, I like the cartoonish drawing of me. I thought you captured it pretty well. So take a look. It's an online skeptical comic, what's not to love. And thanks, Rudis, for keeping us in mind.
Yeah, I'm going through, and he does some pretty funny stuff in here. It's good.
He does indeed. And I believe he posts on our forum as well. So if people check out the comic and like it, you should sign up to the forum and say hello.
Right. The next email comes from Rory O'Connor from Ireland. And Rory writes, "Hey guys, love the show. It has helped me to greatly improve my bullshit detector, or perhaps woo detector is more appropriate. Anyway, I was wondering if you could take a look at this article. It's kind of sad. Is any of this true? Are the ice caps of Mars really melting? Maybe you could point out the logical fallacies. Thanks and keep up the great work. P.S. Oh, I'm not even going to read the P.S. Never mind. Well,
that's
P.S. Yes. Is Rebecca single?
Oh God!
As if that's a big mystery.
Define single.
Define single.
God, don't even. Come on, guys.
You guys are a hoot.
Oh, we have fun, Bob. Tell us about global warming on Mars.
Well, I read the article that Rory linked, and it was really not the focus of the article. It's really just a throwaway comment. The bulk of the article dealt with a teacher at a high school that is in his attempt to offer all sides of the global warming controversy, quote unquote. He played Al Gore's in Inconvenient Truth, and a lot of the parents complained. One of the parents' dad, his name is Mark Colley, said that we may be contributing 1% to global warming. It's largely due to solar activity, and there's not a thing we could do about it, Colley said. The polar caps on Mars are melting, and there's not an SUV or smokestack in sight. And that was pretty much the extent of it.
Melting.
So I did some search on searching around on ice caps and Mars melting, and I came across 2005 data from NASA's Mars Global Surveyor and Odyssey missions revealed that the carbon dioxide ice caps near Mars' South Pole has been diminishing for three summers in a row. Then I came across last year an article from a gentleman named Habibulo Abdusamatov. He's the head of space research at St. Petersburg Pulkovo Astronomical Observatory in Russia. His whole shtick is that the Mars data is proof. You know, since Mars is apparently going through some sort of warming trend, and the Earth, it's obvious that it's because of changes in the sun, and that is proof that it's sun that's causing the global warming, and it's not. There's no significant man-made component.
What's the logical fallacy there?
Well, I forget the exact name of it, but you're saying that because.
It's a hasty generalization, right?
Yeah.
He's generalizing from too small a data set.
Right.
Oh, Mars is warming at the same time the Earth is. Therefore, it's a solar effect. It's everything in the solar system is warming. It's also a non sequitur because it's specifically he's establishing a false dichotomy, and that there is solar warming or man-made global warming, and there can't be both. Well, in fact, that we are coming to the end of a period where solar warming was in fact happening. So we would expect that solar warming would be happening at the end elsewhere in the solar system. But that does not mean that there can't also be man-made global warming factored in on top of that. And as we get to the end of that cycle and we go into a period more a downtrend in terms of the solar contribution, solar forcing, as it were. To global temperatures, it'll probably offset the man-made forcing a bit, which is a good thing, actually. But we'll see. I mean, the thing is, there's multiple trends superimposed on top of each other, and the fact that there are other trends and other sources of warming in no way means that there isn't man-made forcing of global warming.
And some extra details, from what I could tell, the conventional theory is that climate changes on Mars can be explained primarily by small alterations in the planet's orbit and tilt, and not by changes in the sun. All planets experience some wobbles as they make, during their journey around the sun. Earth does the same thing. It's known as the Milankovitch cycle, and they occur on timescales around 20,000 to 100,000 years. And Mars also has no large moon like we do, which makes the wobbles much larger and the climate swings much greater as well. So there's no need to resort to to the fact that the sun is causing this when there's much more reasonable explanations.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this is one tiny slice of the whole global warming controversy. And I do think this is a complex set of data, but this is one of those arenas where I don't feel like I have enough of a mastery of the actual detailed science that I feel free to have my own opinion about it. My position is that my opinion is probably not better than the consensus of scientific opinion. And I really don't see any compelling reason to distrust the consensus on global warming, which is, you know, that there is a man-made component to it. But it is one of the more politically charged issues that we deal with. And I'm sure I'm going to get a slew of emails from people who don't like global warming just because of that comment. But there it is.
I don't like global warming either. I'm just trying to, I don't know, identify with them before they start sending the angry emails.
Okay. One more email before we go on to science or fiction. This one comes from Arthur Ville from Australia, and Arthur writes, Joe Falciatano, 12, began calling himself Magneto Man last year after his teachers concluded that his presence could crash the school computers. I have another name for him, actually. Can this story be legit? And if so, what could cause it? Hmm. Now, I'll say off the bat, I don't buy this at all, but for multiple reasons. You read through the story, and there's lots of examples. Essentially, this kid has had a lot of bad luck with computers. They tend to misbehave when he's using them or when he's just around. Now, if you read through the story, what it sounds suspiciously like confirmation bias. That once the notion that there was some effect that this kid was having, that computers were misbehaving around him, that confirmation bias, searching for confirming examples and ignoring disconfirming examples, took hold. And the rest is the stuff of legends, as they say, right? This is how these kinds of stories develop. It's exactly the same as somebody thinking they're quote-unquote lucky, although there may actually be a psychological effect at play there. But oftentimes, just people, once they think that they're lucky because they happen to have a string of good luck by random chance, then confirmation bias just reinforces that belief. Part of the reason why I say that in this specific case is, one is, if you look at all the examples that are given, a lot of them don't really seem to have anything to do with each other. There isn't a consistent effect here. It's just sort of anything anomalous that happens gets blamed on this kid. Also, a lot of the things they point to seem to be more of like a software problem, not the kind of hardware problem you would expect from static electricity or some kind of physical effect, right? So one example was he might be in Microsoft Word and suddenly he would be unable to change the font. Unable to change the font? How is that an electrostatic effect or magnetic effect? That's just a software misbehaving thing. Maybe the kid doesn't know how to use the computer very well.
Maybe they're using Vista.
Maybe.
And Steve, I want to point out, though, just to briefly correct one thing, is that it's not fair really to compare this to the idea of good luck, because that's not necessarily just confirmation bias. Although confirmation bias has something to do with people who think that they're lucky. People who think they're lucky, a lot of studies show that they actually are quote-unquote lucky, meaning that they take advantage of more opportunities. And people who think that they're unlucky tend to be more pessimistic and tend to miss opportunities that they could otherwise take advantage of. Richard Wiseman has done a lot of research on that, and people are interested
to
check out his book, The Luck Factor, on that.
Right. No, you're absolutely right, and that's actually what I meant when I said that there's a psychological factor to luck, but in addition, it's confirmation bias. So I agree with you. That's what I was referring to. But thanks for that clarification. But confirmation bias is, again, it's a very powerful cognitive, factor that could make, really could make you believe almost anything. It's just once you start cherry picking and selecting selectively noticing and remembering bits of information, it could make almost any belief seem very compelling. And this is read the story that we link to, because it really is a good, in my opinion, a very good example of it. The other reason why I don't buy this is because there's just no physiological mechanism by which somebody would just be producing static electricity or have more static electricity than somebody else. Maybe the shoes that you wear would do it, or something like that, or if you slide your feet across the wool carpet when you walk across it, those kind of things. But static electricity also, wouldn't have this kind of effect on a computer, right? I mean, Bob or Jay, correct me if I'm wrong. It's like, you're not going to start having font problems in Word if you get a little static discharge off your fingertips, right? I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
No, I mean, unless every computer in the school is behaving in the same way and you know, it's the guy's effect isn't proven. It shows that everyone in the room with him has, you know, is having a problem understanding the way computers work. It's just a ridiculous statement. But no, and you can have a static charge and touch your computer, and if the computer's grounded properly, it's not going to do anything. I mean, right. The static discharge. Remember all the static that would come off of a CRT monitor?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, it's like, oh yeah, give it up.
No,
just it's bullshit, and it's obviously see through.
Yeah, and I have an anecdote about magnetic fields and CRT monitors.
Oh, good.
Our EMG. I know you gotta have one of these. Our EMG lab happens to sit right above the MRI suite in the hospital, and the CRT. This is now going back a few years when we had a CRT monitor. Now we all have all LCD, but the CRT monitors, which are susceptible to magnetic fields, you could actually see the magnetic field being produced by the MRI scan. And you would get this rainbow scintillating effect across the monitor.
Kind of a wavy.
And if you turn the monitor around, you could actually move it through, you know, the magnetic field and see it as you did that. It was actually quite annoying. Now they shield it better, and the effect doesn't appear to be a factor for the LCD monitors. But again, they're not describing anything like this with this kid. Again, they're just describing these kind of random computer anomalies. You could also imagine, and they kind of refer to these kind of episodes happening in this article, something anomalous happens, and then somebody says, oh, is Joe around? Oh, yeah, there he is across the room. It must be him. Literally, that's the kind of confirmation bias that's going on with this story.
So ultimately, this is all about human psychology and not superpowers.
That's correct. That's a good summary, Bob. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Or non-superpowers, in fact.
And, you know, if that was your superpower, how freaking lame is that? The
right.
Font doesn't work.
I can bulk erase tapes. Mwahaha.
That would be pretty cool. If you could just blank out hard drives, that would be a neat power. But, you know.
There's a movie about that now, right?
Yeah.
Kind, rewind. Yeah. I think that's probably where this is coming from.
Right. I mean, that's at least something, right? I mean, wiping out hard drives and tapes or whatever. But just, you know, having font problems in Word, I mean, I agree, that's like the lamest power ever. It's not quite up there with Salinity Man, the Scientology powers, or Hunger Man.
Well, that guy was sensing hunger.
Yeah. I sense thirst. We must move this way. You know, also another fun thing that would probably get tired quick, but it would be cool if you could instantly make somebody's you know, computer play like really loud, nasty porn, like while they're at work, just walk by and bing.
Oh, there are viruses that do that.
Yeah, I there put that on a coworker's computer once. It was hysterical me. I mean,
yeah, for you.
It popped up like a little male stripper every 10 minutes or so.
Oh, that's awesome.
Do a little dance. It was kind of awesome.
Well, let's move on, shall we?
No.
Can we?
Oh.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts. Two are genuine and one is fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Although this week, we're going to do something a little different because I'm actually on vacation and Bob is prepping a lot of the show for me. So Bob is going to do the science or fiction this week. This is the second time that you're picking up the science or fiction mantle, right, Bob?
I believe second or third. Okay. One of those.
And I will be put into the role of guesser this time.
Wow. So, Steve, if you win this one, your average could go way up.
Way up. I'm like 0 and 3 at this point.
Okay. I've got a theme. I actually have a theme. No, the theme is the letter C.
Autonomics.
The C word. Gotcha.
Okay.
The C word. We are dealing with caterpillars, cannibalism, and colds.
Okay.
Mm. Okay, number one. A new study shows a moth can remember what it learned as a caterpillar. Number two, cannibalism may have killed Neanderthals. Neanderthals who practiced cannibalism may have spread a mad cow-like disease that weakened and reduced populations, thereby contributing to their extinction, according to a new theory. And number three, influenza viruses bind together more readily in cold temperatures, which protects them. This finding could explain why winter is the flu season, U.S. researchers report.
And I think
Steve,
me.
Go first.
Yeah.
You want me to go first, huh?
I sure do.
Well, first of all, we want to say you did a great job. These are all highly plausible. I'll say, new study shows a moth can remember what it learned as a caterpillar. That means the only reason why you would even think to guess, to question whether or not they could, is because caterpillars go through a rather significant metamorphosis, and the so-called imaginal discs, which contain the DNA that manifests the moth, right? So basically, the caterpillar turns to goo.
I can neither confirm nor deny any of this, but
yeah, the caterpillar turns to goo, and then the imaginal discs turn into the moth. So the question is, could enough structure survive that process that the memories would that the moth would have some memory?
Jesus, Steve, what do you not know about?
It's plausible either way.
Steve is playing the part of Bob today.
Cannibalism may have killed Neanderthals. Neanderthals who practiced cannibalism may have spread a mad cow like disease. You know, that actually was happening. The kuru was being spread by the ritualistic eating of the brains of one's ancestor.
And shearing the scrotum.
The ritualistic brain eating. So I guess it's possible, that they discovered evidence that Neanderthals had a kuru or a mad cow-like disease as well. Influenza virus binds together more readily in cold temperatures, which protects them. And that could explain the winter flu season. I don't know that we need that to explain the winter flu season. I think just patterns of behavior are probably enough. But again, it's not implausible.
Yeah, huh?
And I do not remember. I've been reading a lot of science news this week while I'm on vacation, so I haven't read any of these. So I'm just going to have to flat out guess. So I will say that Neanderthal cannibalism is the curveball, and that one is the fake.
Okay. Rebecca.
Well, Steve just took like 10 years to get through that. So I'm going to get to the point and say that I think that the flu viruses binding together sounds suspicious to me, because as Steve said earlier, I don't think we really need that to explain why winter is the flu season. So, yeah, that one is the fiction, I think.
Okay, Jay.
I can't see how they can test a caterpillar that turned into a moth remembers anything. That one just seems outer limits to me. The cannibalism with the Neanderthals, I agree with Steve. Like, sure, food's running out. It makes perfect sense. I could see that happening. And the influenza virus binding together. I don't know enough about this, and it doesn't sound implausible to me. If number one is true, Bob, I'm really going to question the study, even if you did read it. If the one about the moths is true, I'm gonna go with that one as the fake.
Okay. Evan.
Yeah, I don't understand. How do you measure what a moth can remember as it learned as a caterpillar? What did they do? Did they pay attention to what the caterpillar was doing until it turned into a moth, and then see if the moth went back to kind of relive some of where it was,
right?
Or what it was doing as a caterpillar? I'm really baffled as to how they structure that.
Unless the caterpillar turns into Mothra.
I didn't think
it's probably just either affinity or aversion.
You're done, Steve.
Some stimulus.
Steve, you're done.
I know, Steve. Have you never played this game before? I mean, that's not the way it works.
It's been a couple of years.
I probably would have gone with the moth.
Oh, like you guys never throw comments out from the peanut gallery.
Steve, we're very good.
But based on Steve's comments, I'll instead say that the influenza virus is the fiction story. So I'll agree with Rebecca.
It's a good philosophy in general.
Let me roll my dice here, see which number I'm going to go with. Okay, two.
I miss Gary.
Cannibalism may have killed Neanderthals. That is science.
Nice.
Yay. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Steve.
Kept my perfect record getting everyone wrong.
You suck, Steve.
Boy, you really
okay,
blow
at Neanderthals.
This game.
Yeah.
Took like 10 minutes to come to that wrong conclusion. Jeez, Steve.
At least Bob gets some right, Rebecca? At least Bob.
I know. Bob takes 6 years.
I don't have a lot of practice playing this game, right?
Oh, wow.
It's true, and you're on vacation.
All right. Enough whining. Let's go through what actually the actual real science is saying about this. I have here from the study that the theoretical model could resolve the longstanding mystery of what Neanderthals which emerged about 250,000 years ago, and they disappeared about 30,000 years ago. Simon Underdown, a lecturer in the anthropology department at Oxford Brookes University, studied a well-documented tribal group, the Fore, F-O-R-E, of Papua New Guinea, who practiced ritualistic cannibalism and linked that to what could have happened to the Neanderthals. Also, there is evidence, 100,000 to 120,000-year-old bones discovered at a cave in France suggest a group of Neanderthals defleshed the bones of at least six other individuals and then broke the bones apart with a hammer, stone, and anvil to remove the marrow and brains.
Look at the bones.
Okay, let's see.
Wait, that's it? That's the evidence?
Summarizing.
Wow, Steve.
But I mean, there's no...
Steve, check out our...
I was wondering if there was going to be any actual evidence of any prion disease among the Neanderthals. Did they find anything in the, you know, that's pretty thin.
It seemed they based it on the fact that they, it seemed that the Papua New Guinea group of people and the evidence of cannibalism might be the two main pieces of his evidence. Although, I'll send you the link. Check out the article. But those are the two things I gleaned from it.
All right, pretty speculative.
That seemed most relevant. I could have missed a bit that mentioned that. Evidence of actual prion disease, but how are you going to find that?
That was my question.
Evidence in fossils, yeah.
That was okay. My question, right.
Let's see. Now, my die is telling me to go to number one. Okay. New study shows a moth can remember what it learned as a caterpillar. That is science.
Oh, shit.
The Georgetown researchers found that tobacco hornworm caterpillars could be trained to avoid particular odors delivered in association with a mild shock. So, Steve, you were right. And, Evan, you should be thanking Steve. When adult moths emerged from a pupae of trained caterpillars, they also avoided the odors, showing that they retained their larval memory. The Georgetown University study is the first to demonstrate conclusively that associative memory can survive metamorphosis in Lepidoptera, the order of insects that include moths and butterflies, and provokes new questions about the organization and persistence of the central nervous system during metamorphosis. So very interesting stuff there.
That's bullshit.
And that means I'm right, I think.
Heaven.
Yeah. That means
so. Influenza viruses bind together more readily in cold temperatures, which protect them. That is fiction. The actual science here is the influenza virus coat themselves in fatty material that hardens and protects them in cold temperatures.
Mm-hmm.
And some more details. Let's see. Experts have long pondered why flu and other respiratory viruses spread more in winter. No one explanation, such as people staying indoors more or the destructive effect of the sun's radiation in summer, has fully explained it. So Rebecca, you were a little wrong in that regard, but you still guessed right.
The new report
published in the journal Nature Chemical Biology could lead to new ways to prevent and treat flu, says NICHD director Dwayne Alexander. So it's a fatty shell around the virus that hardens in the winter, which prolongs its stay outside of the respiratory tract of humans. And it says here that the butter-like coating melts in the respiratory tract, allowing the virus to infect cells. So that hard shell—it's
like butter.
Allows it to, that's what allows it to survive so long outside the body. Whereas in the summer, since it's warm out, it would die more readily, and it's much less chance for people to catch it after it's dead. So because it survives so long, that's one of the reasons it seems that influenza is so nasty in the winter, because it can survive outside the body for much longer. So,
good job, Bob. I like that.
So, good job,
well,
everybody.
Good job, Bob.
I mean, everyone selected a different one, pretty much. So, I think that's a good.
Yeah, you did a good job, Bob.
It's the best I could hope for.
Yeah, that's always a good sign when you totally split all three.
And Steve, it takes longer than you might think. Oh, I'll read a few things and select these. It takes a while. I spent literally, almost an hour just going through all these things, trying to figure out, what I could change and which ones sounded somewhat reasonable or not, maybe not plausible. Mm-hmm. So it's tricky. It's not as easy as you might think to put this together. So kudos to you, Steve, for doing this every damn week.
Yeah. I'll say, you better be careful. If you do too good a job, I'll make you take it over from me.
No, Steve, because then you'd have to get it wrong every week.
That's true.
Yeah, it's true. You also can't be schmarmy to us, Steve, which you'll miss.
I know. I do love the schmarminess. I live for that each week. Well, Jay.
Yeah.
Do you have a quote for us this week?
Well, do we want to make a correction based from last week?
Oh, that's right. Evan, you screwed up last week, and you got to make a correction. What was that?
Excuse me. Okay. I will clarify last week's quote.
Yeah, I love that word, clarify. Yeah, clarify covers up a lot of sins.
Okay. It's not exactly John McCain talking about autism here. So, so what happened last week when we came up with a quote for last week's episode was that I had opened the book Flim Flam and went right to the end of the introduction and, of course, read the quote, which I assumed was written by James Randi. And it turns out that it was not. It was Isaac Asimov who wrote the introduction for Flim Flam. So we had several listeners write us and made us aware of that correction, and we are officially now making that correction. So last week's quote was, in fact, Isaac Asimov. So we stand corrected.
So, Jay, do you have another quote for us this week?
Well, yeah, since we screwed up last week's quote, I will give a proper Isaac Asimov quote and give him the proper credit. Mr. Asimov said, "There is a single light of science, and to brighten it anywhere is to brighten it everywhere."
Actually, I think that's a Randy quote.
You know, crap. Rebecca, there was a dramatic pause after my quote.
I know, and I stole it from my joke.
You stepped all over it.
We were all waiting for it.
I did it on purpose.
And, do it, Jay. Do it.
I don't know. I just don't feel it. No.
Come on. I feel it. I'm waiting.
The moment is fading.
No, it's not. It's there.
I'll do it. It's Isaac Asimov.
No, Rebecca, you can't rescue it now. You ruined it. You can't bring it back. Well, thank you, Jay.
We got fans requesting this.
Yeah, that was kind of like giving mouth-to-mouth to some roadkill or something.
We had fans specifically requesting Jay stop it.
That's really? True.
No, I didn't see any of that.
Did we?
Don't exaggerate. It was one fan.
What'd they say?
Please, God, stop it.
But when did it become an it? It's just a stupid little thing that I do. Like, what's the deal? Like, who cares?
Right, exactly.
It's a good point.
Right.
The fans care, Jay. The fans. That's what's important. That's why we're here. Okay.
Jay, well, keep doing it, Jay.
That particular person.
Jay, wait. Keep doing it.
This is the episode that I won't do it for that particular person. They can always know that this episode, it wasn't done for them.
What if they retroactively listen to this episode?
Then they'll never know.
I wish we could actually remember the person's name so that we
I do. It was that guy.
Oh, the guy with the hair
and the eyes. Yeah, right. Him.
I have a small announcement that should be fun. I have started up a Boston Skeptics in the Pub, which is a monthly gathering based on one that happens every month in London. My friend Sid runs it over there, and he encouraged me to start one here in Boston. It's a social event. It's a lot of fun. Skeptics and scientists and critical thinkers, they come out to the pub and meet and drink, and there's always going to be a special guest to do a talk. And for our first event, which is Monday, March 24th, at the Asgard in Central Square, Cambridge, we're going to have Mike the Mad Biologist, who is a science blogger for Seed Magazine. You can find out more by going to bostonskeptics.com.
Excellent.
It's going to be a good time.
Always good to have more skeptical events. Can't have too many.
Oh, yeah.
Well, thanks for joining me all again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah, 13 votes away from being on the second page of all of the podcasts on Dig, and it's just, you know, meaningless positioning, but
Dig it.
I don't know why.
That's kind of sad.
It's important.
Go page two.
And I'd like to say again, I really missed you guys. I'm really glad to be home. I'm going to definitely...
Wait, no, at the beginning of the show, you said you were miserable to be home.
I instant messaged you in secret that the weather here just sucks so bad. I said that, didn't I?
Yes.
You said it on
You actually said it out loud.
Oh, I said other nasty things to you.
You said it for all of our listeners to hear.
Just listen. This is so pathetic, but yes, I'm going to contact everyone that's going to help me with the new website very soon, I promise. I'm just, you know, overwhelmed.
And Jay, one of your first projects is to make a book review page, because we had a lot of requests to post up all of our book, our skeptical book reviews, and we will do that. That's part of this wonderful website upgrade that Jay is going to be doing with all of his volunteers.
You know, that's a good idea, Steve. Any listeners that have some cool suggestions on just things that we could do with the website, and also with Mike's SGU fan site, if you have any good ideas or anything, just please email us from the site. We'd love to hear your ideas. Thank you.
Well, thanks again, everyone, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.